Vedam samatittane.
Vedam samatittane.
Vartamanani sarjuna.
Vartamanani sarjuna.
Bhavishyani ca bhutani.
Bhavishyani ca bhutani.
Mam tu vedana kaschana. O Arjuna, as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, I know everything that has happened in the past, all that is happening in the present, and all things that are yet to come. I also know all living entities. But me, no one knows. Purport. Here the question of personality and impersonality is clearly stated. If Krishna, the form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, were Maya, material, as the impersonalists consider him to be, then like the living entity he would change his body and forget everything about his past life. Anyone with a material body cannot remember his past life, nor can he foretell his future life, nor can he predict the outcome of his present life. Therefore he cannot know what is happening in past, present and future. Unless one is liberated from material contamination, he cannot know past, present and future. Unlike the ordinary human being, Lord Krishna clearly says that he completely knows what happened in the past, what is happening in the present, and what will happen in the future. In the fourth chapter, we've seen that Lord Krishna remembers instructing Vivasvan, the sun god, millions of years ago. Krishna knows every living entity because he's situated in every living being's heart as the Supersoul. But despite his presence in every living entity as Supersoul and his presence as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the less intelligent, even if able to realize the impersonal Brahman, cannot realize Sri Krishna as the Supreme Person. Certainly the transcendental body of Sri Krishna is not perishable. He's just like the sun, and Maya is like a cloud. In a material world, we can see that there is the sun, and that there are clouds and different stars and planets. The clouds may cover all these in the sky temporarily, but this covering is only apparent to our limited vision. The sun, moon and stars are not actually covered. Similarly, Maya cannot cover the Supreme Lord. By his internal potency, he is not manifest to the less intelligent class of men. As it is stated in the third verse of this chapter, out of millions and millions of men, some try to become perfect in this human form of life. And out of thousands and thousands of such perfected men, hardly one can understand what Lord Krishna is. Even one is perfected by realization of impersonal Brahman or localized Paramatma, he cannot possibly understand the Supreme Personality of God at Sri Krishna without being in Krishna consciousness. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Ginandana Salakya Chakshurum Militam Yena Tasmai Si Gurave Namaha. The ordinary materialist is looking everywhere but cannot find any proof of the existence of God. If there is a God, then how can we know him? If everything is going on by a divine plan, then how can we be so sure? Because why not everything going on by chance, by laws of nature? How do we know? We cannot see. Therefore, many people in this world are saying, well, the question whether there is a God or not is difficult to resolve. Then there are others. And they say, no, but there are too many miracles in this world. In fact, this very world itself is a miracle. After all, how did it all come into being? It is easy to say that once there was a great explosion some 10 billion years ago, and that then different chunks of matter were flying through the external space, and eventually became the different planetary systems where living, where all kinds of living beings came about by laws of natural selection. But it raises many questions. It raises many questions. How did such complexities come all about? Just by chance, here we are, all these different complex living beings. So, little difficult to believe for some. So some say, no, there must be some greater plan behind it all. There must be some connecting factor. There must be a Supreme Lord. If there is, then everything that exists must come from Him. Then, if there is a God, then He must be the sum total of everything that exists. Then, others are saying that God is a person, is a cowherd boy, bluish, with peacock feather and crown, and flute, and walking around with cows. But how can such a person be God, logically speaking? If we say that everything that exists is the energy of God, if the whole universe is the energy of God, then how can He walk around in that universe? If the total is God, and then He Himself, as a tiny being, is walking within that universe, then how can He be God? He showed it. He showed it to His mother.
To His mother?
Yes, to His mother. Because on one occasion, his brother said that Krishna had eaten clay. Krishna eaten clay? So, all the boys said, Krishna has eaten clay. Krishna said, it's not true. They are lying. They are cheating. It is not true. If you don't believe me, right, then what can I say? I am your son. Would I cheat you, my mother? She said, well, they're all saying that you ate it. Right? So I think maybe you are lying. If you don't believe me, mother, then just look in my mouth and see if you can find any clay there. She said, all right, open your mouth. He opened his mouth, and Mother Yasoda looked inside, and what did she see? Not just a little bit of clay, but a lot. She saw the entire universe in the mouth of Krishna, with all the varieties of planetary systems and so on. And therefore, she saw the actual proof. She saw the proof that He, who is the Supreme Lord, in the form of a person who is walking around on this planet with a flute, etc., at the same time contains all the energy of the universe within Himself. How is it possible? Mother Yasoda could not understand. She also, just like we, said, but how is this possible? What am I seeing? It cannot be true. How can I see the entire universe in the mouth of my son? She was thinking, maybe the demigods are bewildering my mind and make me see this. But why would they do that? Why would the demigods interfere in the life of an ordinary woman? Then, if it's not the demigods, then maybe I'm going crazy. Could be. But then again, I have no history of going mad. So then maybe it is actually the mystical potency of Krishna. Maybe then Krishna is not an ordinary person, although in a way he looks like one. But maybe Krishna is indeed the all-powerful Supreme Lord, like Garga Muni said he was. Maybe then he is God after all, and maybe then I am also not the queen of the cowherd men, but maybe I am just his eternal servant, and so on. Then she saw her child on the ground, and she thought, what rubbish. And she picked him up
put him on her lap and gave him her breast to suck. And in this way, Mother Yasoda, the mother of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, forgot that he was actually the Supreme Lord and the Supreme Controller. So how is all this possible? The logicians find it difficult. But Krishna proves them wrong by showing that the entire universes are existing within his mouth. Krishna proves that he is beyond the limitation of an ordinary person. Krishna is not aging. Krishna stays young. Krishna is not limited in his power. Krishna is lifting Govardhan Hill. Krishna, when anyone had any doubt that he really is the Supreme Lord, then we have chapter 11. Chapter 11 is there for those, for the doubting Thomas. Chapter 11 is there just in case you don't believe at all. If you think, well, how can Krishna be God? For you, there is chapter 11. Let's go and have a look at chapter 11 then. Okay, chapter 10. Chapter 11, there we are. Well, so I guess if you really want to go straight to the core of the matter, you start in the middle somewhere, right? In the middle of the action. If you have no patience, then you immediately want to get to it, right? To the real thing. So we start somewhere in the middle. So in the 11th chapter, Arjuna says to Krishna, O greatest of all personalities, O supreme form, though I see you here before me in your actual position as you have described yourself, I wish to see how you have entered into this cosmic manifestation. I want to see that form of yours. Krishna says, If you think that I'm able to behold your cosmic form, O my Lord, O Master of all mystic power, then kindly show me that unlimited universal self. The Supreme Personality of God had said, My dear Arjuna, O son of Prita, see now my opulences, hundreds of thousands of varied, divine, multicolored forms. O best of the Bharatas, see here the different manifestations of the Adityas, Vasus, Rudras, Aswini Kumaris, and all other demigods. We'll skip a few verses. Arjuna saw in that universal form unlimited mouths, unlimited eyes, unlimited wonderful visions. The form was decorated with many celestial ornaments and bore many divine upraised weapons. He wore celestial garlands and garments, and many divine scents were smeared over his body. All was wondrous, brilliant, unlimited, all expanded. If hundreds of thousands of suns were to rise at once into the sky, their radiance might resemble the effulgence of the Supreme Person in that universal form. At that time, Arjuna could see in the universal form of the Lord the unlimited expansions of the universe situated in one place, although divided into many, many thousands. Then, bewildered and astonished, his hair standing on end, Arjuna bowed his head to offer obeisances and with folded hands began to pray to the Supreme Lord. Arjuna said, My dear Lord Krishna, I see assembled in your body all the demigods and various other living entities. I see Brahma sitting on the lotus flower, as well as Lord Shiva and all the sages and divine serpents. O Lord of the universe, O universal form, I see in your body many, many arms, bellies, mouths, and eyes expanded everywhere without limit. I see in you no end, no middle, and no beginning. So, in this way, Arjuna was seeing the unlimited
Ogen.
Universal form of the Supreme Lord. Of course, Arjuna didn't like that form so much after he saw it and preferred to see the original form of Krishna. But the very fact was that Krishna had that form to display. It was not his original form, but certainly it shows how Krishna is the origin of all the great, great powers. Because generally, when we think of God, then we think he must be all-powerful, all-great, almighty, all-knowing, and all such qualities. That's the definition that exists in all the cultures of the world. Allah Akbar, and so on. Right? He is the greatest, without a doubt. Yes, but that Supreme Lord, he is the greatest. But if he was manifest in front of us as the greatest, how can one relate to the greatest? Just as, imagine we would have to have a relationship with an ant. Would be a little difficult, wouldn't it? I mean, how would you recognize your ant amongst 100 other ones? Which one is it? It's hard to see. They all look the same, isn't it? They're so small. How can you see the difference between your special little ant and all the other ones? And even if you could recognize him, right, how could you get very close to him? And how could he get close to you? Can an ant even see a human being at a glance? When I was involved in architecture, in building big temples, I learned that in order to properly appreciate a building, that when you make gardens around a building, the gardens have to be so big that when you come into the entrance gate, that in one glance you can see the whole building. Then the gardens are the right size. If the gardens are too small, then you come in and then you can only see part of the building, and then you have to look up and then you see the rest of the building. That's not proper. So in the same way, an ant is so small and we are so big, an ant cannot even see us all in one glance. He sees a foot, it's like a mountain. It's as big as a moving mountain. So from the perspective of an ant, we are looking like gigantic flying objects, right? Mountains that sometimes cover all the light, other moments that just like create practical earthquakes, right? Boom, boom, boom. They cannot see a nose and two eyes and all these things, right? Maybe they see one eye, but that eye looks like as the entire blue sky. We look at the blue sky. It is so vast. An ant looks at our eye. It is so big. It is like an ocean. So big. A huge blue ocean. Yeah? Or a brown ocean. Or whatever. Other green oceans. Such kind of colors. In this way, can an ant even conceive of us? Even if an ant can, how can we have a nice relationship with an ant? My dear little auntie. Oh, sorry, you broke your leg. what to do? So small, so tiny. So it's difficult. Difficult for such a small creature to have a relationship with us. But in comparison to the greatness of the Lord, we are the ant. So how can we have a relationship with that great, great Lord? Who is so great and we are so small. So ant-like, and there he is, unlimitedly great. Not possible. Cannot get close to him. The best you can do is fall on your knees and pray, "Oh Lord, oh Lord, oh Lord, please don't send too much rain and send sunshine, but send enough that the grass is green so I can get my milk from my cows," and so on, and pray that he may supply. But what more can we do? So when we say God is great, then we can only think of him as our order supplier. But when God appears in front of us in a form equal to ours, he becomes more approachable. You could even talk to him. You could actually see him. You could perceive him closely nearby. And naturally,
one can relate to him. So this is the reason why the Supreme Personality of Godhead appears in that human form of Krishna, and yet he is not human, because he does not die, he does not forget, he always remembers, he doesn't age. And in that form, he is still the all-powerful Supreme Lord at all times. And in that form, we can serve him. We can actually serve him. And therefore, in the relationship with Krishna, we get the greatest opportunity for service. And therefore, that is the most merciful manifestation of Krishna. That is the manifestation of the Supreme Lord, where we can express our relationship with him to the fullest extent. So this is the understanding of the devotees, and therefore the devotees are more interested in the personal form of Krishna than in that all-pervading universal energy, and so on. From the 11th chapter, which is for the doubters. Yeah. Yes, there is an 11th chapter in the Bhagavad Gita. An 11th chapter, but it doesn't stay there. It's not that it goes up to the 11th chapter and Arjuna was looking for the Supreme Lord and finally in the 11th chapter he revealed his transcendental nature and that was it. He showed his highest form, his universal form. No, quickly at the end of the 11th chapter, Arjuna is requesting Krishna to return to his original form. And he does. In the 12th chapter, Krishna is back in his original form. But this time we know that he has that universal form. We know that he is the all-pervading Supreme Lord. We know it now from direct experience that he is the controller of everything. We know that all energy rests in him, but at the same time, he doesn't need to constantly involve himself with these things. The Supreme Lord, in the 9th chapter, is described as Maya Jakshena Prakriti Suyati Sachara Charam, as the Supreme Controller, but not the type that is constantly pushing buttons or sits there somewhere behind a big computer on top of the clouds, right, typing in sunrise. He probably has a macro for that. S, sun appears, right? R for rain, D for drizzle, W for wind, and then sometimes he does 10 finger typing, and then we get rain, sun, wind, and the whole thing all together. Right? It's not exactly like that, that the Supreme Lord has to control the elements himself. He's doing everything simply by his desire. He himself, natasya karyam karanam savijate, he doesn't have to work. He doesn't work. Some people think that God is constantly working, constantly keeping the planets in their position, constantly keeping the sun rising and setting, and sitting on a cloud watching everyone, and in case he does something wrong, sending punishment, and doing last judgments for people that have just died. Can you imagine? It's like so many people die every day, and he has to personally deal with every case and decide what's going on. It's like, okay, how many are there today? It's quite a bit. Oh, boy. Okay, the waiting room is full. It's a busy day. And there he comes in a white coat, like a doctor, who has to deal with all these patients. These kind of concepts are not divine. The Supreme Lord, natasya karyam karanam savijate, does not have to work. The Supreme Lord is simply engaged in his pleasure pastimes. What would you do if you were God? Enjoy. That's his business, to enjoy.
This is the divine philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita. In no other books of the world are we finding such descriptions. We are finding descriptions about the Lord who is there as a ruler. And if anybody acts against his will or becomes angry, that we find the wrath of the Lord. Beware, beware, thou sinner. Also, the reward of the Lord for the pious, who fly up with angels and halos and all such things, and get a trumpet, right, as a reward, a golden trumpet, and can fly around and play, you know, trumpets or harps, it's whatever you like. Right? So, the rewards are great, right? Golden trumpets, golden harps, the rewards are wonderful, but that's about it. But we never see much about God Himself. God Himself seems to be working. He has to hand out trumpets. He must have like storerooms full of them, unlimited, right? And yes, one for you, one for you. Don't worry, I have enough. You can have one too, right? And then he must have earplugs as well, right? Can you imagine unlimited trumpets being blown in the skies? My God, deafening noise. What a life. So if we think of these descriptions, then something is lacking for an intelligent person. Intelligent person feels there must be something more. But if we hear in Bhagavad Gita how the Supreme Lord is not working, but rather eternally enjoying, then we say, well, that makes sense. Now, for the first time in my life, I read something that makes sense, where the divine realm is described as a perfect realm where the Supreme Lord is engaged in eternal pleasure pastimes. Now, that makes sense. And that the whole idea is that all living beings are joining in those pleasure pastimes. Since he's all-knowing, that every holy book agrees on, right? If he's all-knowing in this world, then he must also be all-knowing in the spiritual world. And if he knows everything that goes on with every living being, then why not have fun? Why not have fun with every living being? That's what we get from Bhagavad Gita. It makes sense. In this way, that knowledge of Bhagavad Gita is very logical. And because it is logical and deep, it satisfies the intellect. It just very much satisfies the intellect that the Supreme Lord is enjoying instead of working. That sounds like being almighty. If we were almighty, would we work? If we had all opulence, why would we work? We only work because we are deprived. We have so many needs and we don't have. That's all. Otherwise, who would work? So in this way, the more we hear about the descriptions about Krishna, we begin to realize that actually he fits the bill. He has all the qualities and all the attributes that logically belong with the Supreme Lord. And therefore, this Krishna consciousness is very convincing. It is very convincing. The more we hear about it, the more convincing it becomes. Although at first sight, we think, God, a blue boy, how is it possible? That doesn't make sense. But then, the more you hear about it, the more you think about it, the more sense it begins to make. If we realize that the purpose of the whole creation and of everything is simply to enjoy. I mentioned yesterday that many people in the world have a concept of heaven that we are meant to enjoy and that God lives there too. Right? But today, we're dealing with, yeah, he happens to live there as well. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter at all. Doesn't upset anyone because heaven is big enough. Yeah, and we can enjoy. Must be full of musicians. Having lots of fun. Yeah. Enjoying like anything, and God lives there too. But today we're understanding that actually he is enjoying. And because he is such an interesting person, everybody is interested in what he's doing. Just like in this world, when there's a great celebrity, some very famous person, famous movie star coming to Stockholm, everybody's a little curious, you know, what's he doing? Everyone has a look at the paper. Page 3. Let's check it out. Check out what this celebrity is doing. Where is he? So this tendency is there in us. So Krishna is much more interesting than any celebrity. Therefore, in the spiritual world, everybody is always wondering, what's Krishna doing just now? What would he be doing? Therefore, everyone is interested in Krishna. And because Krishna is unlimited, he can simultaneously entertain everybody. Not just one, but everybody. That is the nature of the Supreme Lord. So in the spiritual world, it's not that God is there too. He is the center of all attraction. He is the focus of all the action. He is where it's happening. Right? You know, it's always happening somewhere. And it happens to be happening here, right? And because this is the embassy of the spiritual world, where it's really happening all the time. That's actually the secret of Bhagavad Gita.
In 8:20, we go back to the 8th chapter for a moment. Let's go. We find a description. Yet there is an other unmanifest nature other than this world, which is eternal and is transcendental to this manifested and unmanifested matter. It is supreme and is never annihilated. When all in this world is annihilated, that part remains as it is. That which the Vedantas describe as unmanifest and invaluable, that which is known as the supreme destination, that place from which, having attained it, one never returns, that is my supreme abode. And that's what we're talking about. Krishna's supreme abode, which is the real destination, the place to be. That's where it's really happening. And this place is meant to give a little taste of what could be happening there in the spiritual sky. So I'll end. Any questions, any comments?
There's something I've been wondering about for a long time, actually. And that is, we have an eternal relationship with the Lord in the spiritual world. Is that a relationship, a fixed relationship with him, or is it that we can become something else even though we have a certain relationship with him?
Right.
And I've always wondered about that.
So the question is about the spiritual world, and it is said that we have an eternal relationship with Krishna, and that now that eternal relationship has become covered by the illusory energy, but that through this process of bhakti yoga, our original eternal relationship is being reawakened. Therefore, is that relationship fixed? Was it already there? And are we regaining what we had? Or is it that we can
attain some other position in the spiritual world. Nitya siddha krishna prem sadhya kabunai shravana nisuda chitta karyo udaya. That the living entity has his eternal loving relationship with Krishna, and he is always situated in his eternal relationship with Krishna. When he is covered in this material world by the process of hearing and chanting, gradually within his heart, that original love for Krishna and his original relationship is again reawakening. Srila Prabhupada many times told that the spiritual body was already there. In one conversation with Hansa Dutta really stayed on the cutting edge with his questioning. And he asked many questions. And Prabhupada, he asked, well, so, can the Swarup, or the eternal spiritual form of the living being, change? Prabhupada said, why would it change? Right? When the relationship that a person has with Krishna is fully satisfying, why would one want to change? No, but can he change? Yeah. So somewhere in that conversation, Prabhupada does say, well, he may. But then again, he returns to his original point. Why would he? We find in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, we find the story of Gopu Kumar and how Gopu Kumar was a cowherd boy in the spiritual world who was sent down to the material world to bestow his mercy upon one particular brahmana and went through a long journey to come back to the spiritual world. So at one point there's a description how Gopu Kumar comes back. And when he comes back to the spiritual world, he actually returns to the same position where he was before. He again becomes Swarup, the cowherd boy. The same cowherd boy he was before. And Krishna is actually saying, when Krishna sees him for the first time as he's back, Krishna faints. The gopis think this must be an agent of Kamsa. Balaram says it's okay and says to Swarup, chant in the ear of Krishna. Krishna regains consciousness and says, Swarup, I haven't seen you for such a long time. Come, you must take prasadam with me and Nanda Maharaj today. And he takes him home with him and shares with him very intimately. So this is one description of coming back to one's original form. Still, there are some other indications also. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, in the Adi Lila, we find a description where it is said that generally the associates of Lord Nityananda and Advaita Acharya are either in the Sakyaras, in the fraternal cowherd boy mood, or in the parental mood. But by the association of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they can also develop the conjugal mood. So like from that description, it is a clear mention about change. Now some have tried to explain that and said that, well, actually they're gopis, but temporarily they acted like cowherd boys. But that also doesn't seem like a satisfactory answer. So it seems that by the association of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, it would be possible to change also. But that generally it's not happening, because everyone is very satisfied. We see also the example of Murari Gupta, who was Hanuman. He was again Hanuman appearing with Lord Chaitanya, and Lord Chaitanya had told Murari Gupta, who was worshipping Ram, he told him, you should stop worshipping Ram, you should worship Krishna, because worship of Krishna is higher than Ram. And the next morning Murari Gupta, he had not slept the whole night, he couldn't sleep, and he threw himself at the feet of Lord Chaitanya and he said, better I die.
He said, because you have ordered me to give up the worship of Lord Ram, but I cannot do it. And I can also not disobey your order. Therefore, better I die. So Murari and Lord Chaitanya said, this is wonderful. And he wrote Ram Das on his forehead. And he said, you are Hanuman. Yes, you are glorious for worshipping Lord Ram. So generally, changing rasa and changing relationship is something in this world. You know, we in this world we always change relationship. We don't like this marriage anymore. Try the third marriage. And so many other changes. We don't like this place. We don't like that place. Always change. So therefore, we're projecting this mentality on the spiritual reality. Generally, no need to change, but it seems to be possible. Yeah.
I have one idea how to understand this, and I wanted to ask you, this is one of I think I'll tell you, actually, if I sit down and daydream, then I can imagine the whole world, there are lots of people there, I can also have clear, I can make mountains, and all the other people in my daydream, they can be amazed, how can you do that things, we cannot do that. You understand it, can I use this to understand this?
Yeah, why not? Yeah, sure. That is actually not daydreaming, that is meditating on the pastimes of Krishna and trying to understand them. So that is good. We do that. So that's smaranam, remembrance, one of the ninefold processes of devotional service. Sravanam, kirtanam, smaranam, padasevanam. So smaranam is there. So that is good. And the more we hear about Krishna from Srimad Bhagavatam, the more we can try to visualize these things correctly. Like we have heard something about Krishna lifting Govardhan, so we can try to imagine how Krishna is lifting Govardhan. But then, if you really get into it, you can read a lot more about Govardhan. Yeah? Because the acharyas, they give it in detailed description, all kinds of details that you never heard before, and you read that also, and after that you meditate on Govardhan. Oh, then your whole understanding is even deeper, and you see even more details. You know, like if you read in the Harivamsa how big Govardhan is, and that when Govardhan was lifted by Krishna, that Govardhan was so big that some of the demigods that were flying in the sky, they suddenly smashed into Govardhan. Yeah? That's how big Govardhan was. It was blocking the flight route of the demigods. Yeah? So Govardhan was very big. Yeah? So what can we... So the more we hear about Govardhan, the more we can actually visualize the whole thing. So this is very nice. So therefore our visualizing and remembering goes hand in hand with hearing more and more about Govardhan. Then our visualizing becomes deeper and deeper and deeper.
Yeah. But at the same time, also, I'm sitting here and I felt daydreaming all the same, and I'm imagining Leelas in my head. At the same time, I can't even take photo of this.
And you what?
I can enter in my daydream and take part in those pastimes that I'm thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sitting here and I'm daydreaming and I'm in that also together with other things I have imagined.
Yeah, in a way, in a way. Anyway, I was just playing the atheist and I was challenging how to understand Krishna, and I gave the proof that Krishna was not just a small boy, but that at the same time he had the universe in his mouth and that he showed the universal form. So I showed how, for some reason, the Supreme Lord was playing pastimes like a human being. And then I explained why. At the same time, Krishna is superhuman by lifting Govardhan Hill, by showing his universal form. So he's both human and superhuman. So in order to understand his superhuman feature, we need a little bit of what you call daydreaming, what I call smaranam meditation, and I refuse to call daydreaming, and I will keep on calling smaranam, remembering, no matter how many times you try to call it daydreaming again, I will not accept that. I will call it smaranam. And that smaranam is bona fide, because daydreaming sounds like butterflies and daffodils and daylilies and God knows, imaginary thing, elves and all these kind of things, of which people say fairy tales. Right? But smaranam is real. The materialist can deny anything. The materialist may deny that such story is a fact, and they say it is mythology. Of course, then we hit him back, and we will try and do anything we can to establish that Krishna is a historical person, and that the activities of Krishna are not just mythological, but that they actually took place. And that we'll also try. The hardcore atheist will keep on denying and denying and denying. That's all right, you know. It was not for the hardcore atheist. For the hardcore atheist, we have arguments that are much drier and less interesting, but effective. Right? And ultimately, we have to, with the toughest atheist, one can always enter into one debate, and that is that. First thing is, why is an atheist so sure there is no God, my dear atheist? Congratulations, I have not met anyone with so much faith as you for a long time. Someone who really believes with so much conviction that there is no God. What faith you have. Wonderful. Such deep belief you have. Other people, they say, we are not sure. But you are one who really believes. That usually works well for their blood pressure. Yeah? So that's the first line of attack. Then we go, well, so very soon that atheist will say, okay, yes, well, of course, we don't know if God exists or not, right? So, okay, very good. Then we have him already a step closer, right? So then we'll say, now let us just observe the situation of people who say that there is no God. Okay, what's your reality? There is no God. The average age is about 70, 71, 72, and then you're going to die. And probably most of that, a good part of that life, you're going to be old and decrepit. How does it feel? You want a drink? You sure you don't? You want a drink? Then you're going to just rot very soon. And then afterwards, there's absolutely nothing, right? Nothing. Zilch. Everything that you love, your mother, will all be taken away. Your children, your dog, your canary, everything you love, it will be destroyed right in front of your eyes. You sure you don't want a drink? I'll pour you one right now. Yeah. You'll see that, where is that atheist who can be sober, who can face the hard world without his drink? Yeah. Where is he? Yeah. Where are those people that can face... Where are the atheistic, materialistic people who can live without all the intoxicants to feel a little better? Where are they? Because that reality is depressing. You need something to deal with that. But if you are eternal, if you never die, and if you engage in devotional service and you have an eternal, blissful relationship with the Supreme Lord, then you don't need any drinks to feel better. Yeah, some some water, some lassi or something like that, but no alcohol. So just by the result, yeah, there is a better way of life.
And so, it is not only Kadambakanana Swami who says that, where is it in this edition, but even, mind you, great scholars, this is of course a funny edition, the author references 873. I think it's the wrong way around. Is it? No. What is this edition? Printed in England. Anyway, here's a useless edition of the Bhagavad Gita, maybe, which doesn't include the all the nice references that have been given in the one that Prabhupada published.
Excuse me.
Wait a minute. Let me finish, please. Where it is said by one Professor Powell from the New York, from some university in New York, who says that if the pragmatists, such as Pierce, if there is any truth in their words, that the truth is that which works, then we can see in the life of the Hare Krishna devotees, by the happiness that they have attained, that there must be some truth in the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. Unfortunately, I'm not reciting it as nice as it was printed in the copy that I have in my bag at home. But that's the point. There is truth in this, because we have a better way of life. No drinking, no smoking, no prostitution, no gambling, no trouble. It's a better way of life. Bhagavad Gita. Yes.
Why? I don't know. But
let me ask this question again. Why? I am thirsty, and lo and behold, there is water to quench my thirst. I am hungry, and just see, there is food for me to eat. I feel warm, I feel like taking a dip in cooling waters that soothe my skin. And yes, cooling waters are there. Whenever I experience a need, there is an answer to that need also. And there was a man, and a man was a woman, and all that kind of thing. And there she was. And woman wants man,
and there he was.
And all that, and every time when we have a need, there is an answer. But the atheist said, and then there was a religious need in man, right? And then man said, and then there was God. No, the atheist said, that is just a product of your mind because you want to feel secure there. You're creating this. This is all your imagination. But water is there. Food is there. Nature is there, everything is there. Whenever I have a need, there is an answer. But to my religious need, when there is an answer, no. That's the projection of your mind. Inconsistent, Mr. Atheist. Inconsistent. This is the psychological argument which we use to smash the atheists over the head. Oh la la.
regardent tout ça,
yes,
mais quand même, il faut réfléchir un petit peu.
Bien sûr, bien sûr. Well, that's why I'm asking the question.
Oui.
But don't you think that the people who don't believe in God, they think that afterlife is not there? Can't you respect it?
Can we respect the people that don't believe in God? Never. No, well, you know, I can respect any patient in a mental hospital as a human being, but I cannot respect him for his philosophy and his outlook in life, because he's a madman and his outlook in life is going to cause trouble. So I can respect any human being, even an atheist, but not for his beliefs, because his beliefs are going to cause pain and misery to all living beings.
Well, it depends, because I know people who don't believe in God,
yeah,
and they went to help people in Afghanistan.
That's humanism. Humanism. They want to help, but they cannot help.
Yes, they do very well.
No, you cannot.
Humanitarian help.
Yeah, but humanitarian help is not real help, because even if you feed the poor, even Mother Teresa, who took the beggars off the street and put them in a nice bed, can temporarily relieve their suffering, but she cannot change their karma, and therefore those beggars will suffer again in the future. So all humanitarian help cannot relieve the karma, which is the cause of the suffering, and therefore it is like a temporary relief, and then the suffering will come back. Just like some allopathic medicine which pushes the disease down but never cures us, and it continues, and then it comes out again somewhere else, right? And even after all the aspirins and all the pills that you pop, still the same disease continues and pops up again in the form of cancer.
Because
and then,
life,
fini.
Because life is suffering, my dear.
Life is suffering in the material world. But real life is nectar at every step, when that life is in relationship with Krishna.
Yeah, of course.
And that can be here or there in the spiritual world. Two letter?
What do you say? You
see it, sorry. Ah, oui. C'est ça. Non, c'est vraiment, n'est-ce pas? But we are not out to condemn people in the world.
No.
But atheism will not help the world. As Jesus said, hate the sin, not the sinner. So we don't hate the sinner, but we hate the sin. Anyone else? Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.